This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The rule, we're told, is that left-brained people are good at maths and science, and right-brained people are creative and good at art, and that neither the twain shall meet. But we're also told there's always an exception that proves the rule. Kia ora and welcome to Sightlines, your guide to the visual arts in and around Dunedin. I'm Sally McMillan and this show is brought to you on behalf of the Dunedin Public Art Gallery Society. This month on Sightlines, our guest is Pam McKinlay, an artist-curator who for over a decade now has worked on the Art and Science Project, navigating the interface between those two disciplines in ways that defy the rule and prove the exception, year after year. Pam, welcome to Sightlines.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Now, your combined art and science background goes back to your university years. Let's start by telling us something about your training.
Well, I have a background in applied science from the 1980s, where I specialised in textile science. I did fashion design, I did a BA in art history, and I also did phenomenology religion. So that included things like anatomy and histology, physiology, microbiology, biochemistry, and more specifically food science and textile science. And later on I also did some education papers, and more later on I did some courses at Te Wānanga or Aotearoa o Te Pōti.
So that's quite a lot of art and also quite a lot of science.
Yeah.
As we have this discussion, you're gearing up for the New Zealand International Science Festival, which runs from the 13th to the 16th of July, so just next week. The Arts and Science Project has a full programme of activities during the week, and we're going to talk about those shortly, but I want to start with you telling us about how the Art and Science Project came about.
Well, the Art and Science Project started in 2013 with Dr. Ruth Napper from the Anatomy Department at the University of Otago, and she initiated a project encouraging artists and scientists to share ideas and have conversations, with the idea that the artists would create works that were inspired by those conversations. She approached Peter Stupples at the Dunedin School of Art, and they organised the first Art and Science Project, which was neuroscience, in 2013. And I was taking part in those projects in those days as working on the publication side, which is kind of my part-time job at the Polytech.
Right. And I think there's been a project with a different theme each year since then until 2022, when I think like a lot of major events, it was decided to run the exhibitions every second year.
Yes. So the first theme was neuroscience, and then we've done anatomy, art, light, space, genetics, oceans, water from the mountains to the sea, earth, air, and last year, the last one before this one was memory, and this year we're doing time.
Right. So Ruth Napper, to go back to Ruth for a moment, is of course a fine example of a scientist who is also an artist, because she retired from the anatomy department at the university in 2021 to properly launch her second career as a jeweller, and she makes very lovely jewellery. In her retirement announcement, the anatomy department described the Art and Science Project as her brainchild, through which she was able to combine her passion for neuroscience with her love of art, using art as a medium for attracting the Otago art community to science and vice versa. You took over the curation and coordination of the project from Ruth in 2018. How did that come about?
By that time, I'd taken part in three projects as an artist, as well as working on the publication side. I actually searched wide and far for somebody to kind of pick up Ruth's role when she said she was going to retire. Also, Peter was retiring. I couldn't find anyone mad enough to carry on, so I kind of took up the baton, as it were.
You decided you yourself were that mad person.
Well, it's quite a lot of work, as Ruth said.
Yes. And yes. I guess the fact that it was so hard for you to find somebody is perhaps in itself an indication of the fact that the people that are capable of doing that are exceptions that prove the rule.
I think the intersection for me between art and science in one way is about systems thinking. And I have one of my favourite evolutionary biologists is Robert Sapolsky, who uses an example of clock understanding and cloud understanding. So you can take a clock apart and examine each gear, spring and cog, and put it back together again, and that's the strength of reductionist thinking or scientific systems. But some things are more like clouds. You can't pull a cloud apart and examine each. You can pull a cloud apart. You can examine what's, you know, each part of the cloud is doing, but you can't put it back together again. It's the relationships which create the phenomena of the cloud, and it's a system. So many of the challenges we face today, climate change, biodiversity loss, social inequality, these are all cloud problems rather than clock problems. They're complex systems where relationships matter as much as the individual cogs or components. And that's where I think art science becomes valuable, because science helps us understand the parts. Thank you, science, for bringing us climate change. But art helps us to share stories and perceptions about the relationships, patterns, and lived experience that emerge from the whole. And we all have to live with that. So we need another way of looking at the world that is not just grounded in data.
Which is where the combination of art and science becomes so important. So 8 years on, you're still going strong, and so too is the project. How many artists and scientists are usually involved, Pam, each year?
It changes. A really nice number is 15 of each.
Right.
We've got about 40 people involved this year, and there'll be maybe 32 artworks or mini installations, because not everybody confines themselves to one artwork. And some works are big and some works are small. It varies from year to year. We never have any shortage of people wanting to be involved, rather
than
the opposite.
Yeah. So tell us about the process for the project. What does it involve for you each year?
I have the great privilege of thinking about what the theme is going to be for the next project. So the year in between projects, I usually research an idea that is like unfinished business from the previous project. So the previous project for us was Memory and Mind. So looking at how our memories are created, and as soon as you're looking at that, ideas of memory and cognition, you're looking at time. So I felt like it would be quite fun to take a deep dive into time and look at our perceptions of time and ask the questions, do we exist in time or does time exist in us, which is a quote from a Carlo Rovelli. So, yeah.
Right. So what do you have in store for us this year for those who are attending the festival?
Well, there'll be a beautiful exhibition with an incredible catalogue to walk around the exhibition with if you're just the white space going to an exhibition kind of person.
And that's in the community gallery in Princes Street, right?
And because we're part of the science festival, I usually put a small classroom in the middle of the exhibition. In the morning we have some activities for children. In the afternoon we have some workshops. There's a small fee for the materials in those workshops. And in the evening we have events on Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, including a performance piece by Alan Murray, which draws on concepts from physics, exploring configuration space-time. And on the Tuesday night there'll be a writers and readers, poets, dance performance and a music evening. So there's a bit of something for everybody, and there'll be gallery talks as well.
And something for people of all ages too, which is a really attractive feature, I think, of what it is that you do with this. I want to go back to the floor talk that you yourself are giving, and I think that's just for listeners' benefit. That's on Tuesday, the 14th of July at 2 p.m. at the Community Gallery. And this is an event that will be of interest to a lot of people, and it's titled Once Upon a Time. Tell us about that.
So the floor talk, I was approached by the Friends of the Dunedin Public Art Gallery to do a floor talk. That's since grown to include the Friends of Tuhuru and the Friends of the Dunedin Public Library.
I've got a lot of friends, Pam.
I've got a lot of friends. And all the friends I don't know yet are also welcome. So it's just a guided floor talk around the exhibition, looking at some of the ideas that the artists and scientists have chosen to explore in this theme, whether it's a measurement of time or our experience of time. And so during the project, I've been coming to this idea about a whakapapa of space-time, or a genealogy or history of space-time, which is looking at our prior, current and future relationships and connections in both space and time. So thinking across multiple scales of family histories, migration histories, ecological relationships, our planetary history and cosmological histories. And so these are all part of our whakapapa of space-time. And it reminds us that nothing exists in isolation, and that our stories are nested within much larger stories. And then when we move from outer space to our planet, we are looking at grounded space in the time that we've spent shaping the Earth with migration and settlement, colonisation, displacement, everything is an entanglement of our locations and our responsibilities to place into one another.
So time touches everything and everyone.
One of the other things that I often think about is that we're made of space dust. So we're literally the iron, the carbon, the calcium in our bones. It all came from out there.
Mm.
And so we have a relationship even to mountains, to air, to the trees, and not just to each other. And so I think it behoves us to remember that, you know, we are just like this tiny little speck in the universe. But living out a tiny little speck, we should be respectful to all the other little specks that have come from the stars as well.
Yes, indeed. I've seen the list of artists who have contributed to this year's exhibition, and there will not be any spoilers from me today based on that list, but I can say that it will be well worth people's while to make the time to get along to the Community Gallery between the 13th and 17th of July to see this year's Art and Science exhibition, because it will be fantastic. Pam, you mentioned earlier that, as with many festivals, the Art and Science Project is now a biennial event, which leads me to ask, and you did touch on this briefly a moment ago, and I'm going to pick up on that, what do you do in the in-between years? Because I suspect it's something quite interesting.
Well, in the in-between years, I kind of do my own thing, basically. So I find time to do lots of reading. I'm usually exploring ideas for the next project. I do lots of experimenting. Sometimes there's things I've touched on when I've been trying to find a new way to express an idea in the current project, and I want to refine that further. I also have community projects that are kind of community art projects that I run in those second in between years. And those are still art science projects, but they have greater community participation. So I'm going out to schools with the help of people in Enviro schools. In the past couple of years, I've been working with the zoology department on a really cool native bee project, which I've really enjoyed. Native bees are just one of those creatures that really light up my life.
Yes. And of course, you also, and we're going to come back to that project and some of the others in a moment, but you also, very importantly during that time, you're out looking for grants and sponsorships.
Oh, yes. So I only work part-time and I don't work in an academic capacity at the Polytech, so a lot of the time I'm looking for writing grants, looking for sponsorship. When the project was run by Ruth and Peter, they had a little bit more time and leeway in their, I guess, in their job description to do these things, and they also had access to contestable funding. So I'm always throwing my hat in the ring anywhere there's a pot of money, trying to get a little bit of it.
Okay, so
for
any
project
listeners out there with spare money rolling around, Pam will take it off your hands very gladly, yeah, particularly for this project.
Yeah, myself and 40 other artists and scientists.
Yes, well, indeed, we don't want to make you sound selfish here, Pam.
Yeah.
You, in 2024, as part of the ongoing work that you have done, both with the project and personally, you published a very, very beautiful book, which I commend to everybody, which is called Flows Like Water, and it's described as a celebration of the art and science practice of Pam McKinlay, weaver, sculptor, photographer and curator. This book shines a light on your career as an artist, your involvement in the project, and it provides an account of the projects that you've made, curated and been involved in. And it really is an extraordinary, unique publication, which one review says, and I quote, provides a deep account of the kinds of discoveries one can make by bringing together artistic and scientific method in such a way that each approach speaks equally. And that's quite a profound and highly complimentary description of your work, of you, and of this very, very lovely book, Pam, of which I know you are rightly extremely proud. Of the many and various projects that you cover in the book, I'm going to ask you, and it's like asking you to pick a favourite child, I know, so it's a very unreasonable question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Give us a couple of examples of your favourite projects that you cover in the book. And you've mentioned the bees. Tell us a wee bit more about that one, maybe, to start with.
Well, the bee project came about through a meeting with Jenny Jant and Connell McLean from the zoology department, looking at the native bees that I had encountered at the North East Valley Community Garden. Just wanting to highlight that we have these beautiful creatures, these pollinators, these essential native pollinators, and just their uniqueness. They're a threatened species. We have 28 species in New Zealand. 27 aren't found anywhere else in the world. They get a little bit out-competed by introduced honeybees. They're ground nesting bees. They don't sting well.
Got a lot to recommend them, really, haven't they?
They're just incredible. And they've got it always amazes me that they survive in Dunedin because they have a very short flying time. They like nice, still, fine, sunny days, you know.
Challenge for the best of us.
like every summer day in Dunedin, obviously.
Yes. Obviously.
You know, they like a bit of bare, undisturbed ground. So we disturb ground, we change, we're always digging them up. We are constantly destroying their habitat by our change of land use, by planting plants that are attractive to humans but have absolutely zero interest to bees.
Yes, indeed.
So we do a lot of things that suit us but don't actually suit a lot of creatures. No.
One of the things that's quite challenging about having a radio show about art is that we don't have pictures, obviously. But for listeners, Pam's, one of her many talents is as a photographer, and in your book there are some really lovely photographs of bees, which if you weren't already a fan of bees, this is going to turn you, I can guarantee it. Another project that you have been involved in, which is very far removed from bees, has to do with electric cars. Tell us about your electric cars.
Again, well, this is part of kind of systems thinking. So it's an energy system when you're looking at transport. In 2015, pretty much my husband came home and said, we're going to buy an electric car, and I thought he was mad. I went from thinking it was a bonkers idea to like just the best idea in the universe, and I wanted everybody to know about it.
It's obviously very persuasive, your husband.
Well, once you've actually driven an electric car, you just don't go back. And at that time in 2015, there were maybe two or three electric cars in Dunedin. So one day I was driving around Dunedin and I happened to see another person driving one, and we kind of turned around, both of us, and did a bit of U-turns to trying to catch up with each other. And we formed the Dunedin EV Owners Group, which is now the Dunedin EV Group. And back in those days, we were holding rallies, we're having park-ups, letting people drive cars, we're having charging demonstrations just to demystify, you know, plugging in, basically, and also just how amazing they were to drive,
yes.
Alleviate range anxiety. The person I kind of teamed up with was Alan Weldon, who is a bit of an electron geek. He would know where every electron was in an electric motor at any time. I don't. And so we were a great team because I didn't know anything about the technical aspects of an EV, but I knew that they were a really great piece of technology. I mean, it's space technology.
And it's a good thing for the planet, which is where your interest in that really comes from. But I think in developing that interest, you discovered that there's no such thing as a new idea.
No, there isn't. There's never any new ideas. When I was in Suffrage 125, I did a lot of things for Tech Week, also looking at the history of electric vehicles and women's role in driving electric vehicle ownership in the late 19th century. It was just a hilarious ride of history, really, because women didn't particularly like what they called explosion cars, which were gasoline cars. They were hard to start because they were cranked. People would break their thumbs, kind of, there'd be kickbacks from the crank. And electric cars had a pushed-up motor, the kettle.
So electric cars were, in fact, invented initially back at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, so Henry Ford also had an electric car. Henry Ford's wife, Clara, would only drive an electric car. He'd buy her a Detroit Electric every second year. And in New York in the 1890s, there were electric charging stations on pretty much the corner of every street because they were considered like women's shopping trolleys or shopping. They were like parlours on wheels, they were like a sitting room. They would have places to put your flowers in the car. They were kind of driven with a little rudder. And there's a 1905 Baker Electric in Christchurch, which I've had a ride in, which is quite a lot of fun, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I guess one can speculate how much better off we would have been as a planet had we gone down the electric car track way back then rather than the track that we did go down.
Well, much as the world is today, electric cars were taking off in an incredible way. There was a patent on the gasoline car at the time, which Ford refused to pay, and Rockefeller bankrolled his legal defence, and eventually they just bankrupted the electric car manufacturers of the time. There was another kind of electric car revolution in the 1980s. And again, the oil industry kind of hit back. At that time, it was the EV1. It was an incredible, again, another piece of great technology. But because of pressure from the oil industry, all of those cars, which were actually lease cars at that time, were recalled and literally squashed. There's one in the wild in America and a couple without motors in them in museums.
And of course, the whole oil industry issue is of great interest to everybody at the moment. So again, no such thing as anything new. Another project that you yourself have been very much involved in, and I think you've been doing for 10 years or more now, has to do with glaciers. Can you tell us, in the couple of minutes that we've got left, Pam, tell us a wee bit about that?
Years ago, I started this just going and photographing glacial sites, so the lakes in front of glaciers, walking around the mountains. And I've been in discussion with geologists, hydrologists, climate scientists, NIWA, GNS. And over those years, I've created works in response to the glaciers I've encountered. So it's called the Farewell to Glacier series.
And some of the works that you've done, I think, have involved some very beautiful weaving, which there are photographs of in Flows Like Water, your book.
I've basically taken a photograph and kind of format shifted it into weaving is a practice where you can take data and create a woven structure just from that data. So when I'm weaving those glaciers, there is a point at which I'm looking at the start of the glacier, which starts with a snowflake, and then also looking at the forces that create the glacier. So I'm weaving structures within the panels that look at what's happening underneath the surface of the ice. So
yes.
And as they get closer toward the terminus of the glacier, they and break off and into a glacial lake, they become kind of more watery and loose and this, less weave-like.
And your woven work really depicts that very beautifully. Pam, thank you. I think that our discussion today has shown that you yourself are an exception to the left brain, right brain theory. Clearly, you're both an artist and a scientist, and it's been really lovely to have you on the show today to shine a spotlight both on yourself, very much deserved, but also on the art and science project.
Thank you very much. Come along to the exhibition.
Well, we encourage listeners to do just that. Get down to the community gallery for the exhibition between the 13th and the 17th of July and get online to find out more about this year's Art and Science program and to buy tickets. And now here's Jonathan Quayle with the latest on what's happening in the local art scene. This is Snapshot. Jonathan, what's happening at DPAG this month?
Well, sadly, at DPAG this month, there's an exhibition of new and recent paintings by Imogen Taylor called From Behind. This is an exploration of a legacy of modernist painting operating in a space somewhere between abstraction and representation, and that's on throughout July. Also at DPAG, we've got a series of new sculptures by former Francis Hodgkins fellow Nick Austin. These works reflect on the passage of time and stages of life. It's called What Did People Do All Day, and that's also on throughout July. Looking around at the dealer galleries, Milford has a major survey of Nigel Brown's work called Broadly Speaking, Selected Paintings 1985 to 2025. And we're big fans of Nigel Brown's work in this show.
We certainly are.
And this is a major survey of his practice and his vision of a New Zealand identity. And that show includes an artist talk at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday the 25th of July. So get along to that. Over at Gallery De Novo, there's a show called Luster, which is a group exhibition dedicated to metallic effects in art, and that includes everything from gilded surfaces and reflective textures to subtle highlights and radiant textures. Olga in Moray Place features work by Guy Howard Smith, and this show is called Snakes and Rubies. It features a jewel-like selection of works inspired by magic realism and the artist's Anglo-Indian heritage. And down at the Dunedin Railway Station, the Otago Art Society is hosting its 150th annual exhibition, and that's obviously a really major milestone in the long and illustrious history of that magnificent Dunedin art institution.
Yes, and of course we've done a show on the Otago Art Society in the background to the Dunedin Public Art Gallery Society, which listeners might like to go back and listen to. Jonathan, that is quite the selection. What's your pick for the offerings this month?
Well, I really recommend that listeners who haven't seen it already get along to Rhys King's show at the Hocken. This is called the OG and Manaya. It finishes at the end of this month, so there's only 4 weeks to go. King was the Francis Hodgkins Fellow in 2025, and the show is a result of his fellowship year. It was obviously a very prolific year for him. The show is full of big, bold, colourful works and a number of smaller pieces, with motifs drawn from architecture, urban graffiti, indigenous design and more. It's an absolutely stunning exhibition, and there's also a really beautiful book to accompany it, which has been designed by the artist. And I really recommend that listeners get along and see that show before it finishes.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jonathan, and thanks to you, our listeners. If you'd like to hear today's show again or listen to previous shows, you can find us on the Otago Access Radio and DPAG Society websites or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to join the Society, you can also find a form on our website or you can join at Dunedin Public Art Gallery reception. And remember that Society members enjoy a generous 20% discount in the gallery shop, which is a great place to visit if you're looking for art, books, quality homeware and unique gift ideas. Thanks to producer and DPAG Society President Jonathan Quayoff. Join us again next month for another dive into the visual arts in Dunedin and beyond. I'm Sally McMillan and you've been listening to Sightlines.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.